Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with Fallen Woman, a weekly psychic fusion of forward thoughts, far-out ideas, magical foray, and spellbinding song, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.
Warming the Stone Child, Myths and Stories about Abandonment and the Unmothered Child with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes. In the Jungian Storyteller series, Dr. Estes uses folk tales, mythology, and Jungian psychology to teach in her most personal way about the deep inner life. On Warming the Stone Child, Dr. Estes explores the nature of abandonment in childhood, its effects on people in later life, and its curiously special gifts and powers. Dr. Estes is an award-winning author, a senior analyst, and the past director of the C.G. Jung Institute of Colorado in Denver. And now, Warming the Stone Child, Myths and Stories about Abandonment and the Unmothered Child, with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
The most important thing about the unmothered child is that internally there is a light that will never go out. In stories from Mexico, there are many sayings about the light that is internal or external that can never be put out. One of the sayings is about any kind of wood that is half burnt always has a spark or an ember in it that could be fanned by a very small wind into a gigantic flame. And this is the absolute and significant truth about the unmothered child. Even though people who have experienced the terrible pain and humiliation of not being cared for with a loving hand, even though they have experienced those things, they must be assured that surviving is not enough, that one must learn to thrive. And that is what the little flame inside is all about. Fanning that flame into something that's sturdy and doesn't waver every time someone looks at us funny, someone disapproves of us, someone is angry with us, so that that flame burns brightly. That's what healing the unmothered child is all about. One of the signs of the unmothered child, one of the signs of abandonment prior to adolescence, is a syndrome that we call collapsing. Collapsing is where when someone is angry with you or someone acts in a way toward you that's quite negative, instead of remaining as an adult with adult responses, one goes into a psychic regression and gets hooked, so to speak, like a fish hook, on very old feelings, feelings of being worthless, of being unprotected, of not knowing what to do next, of wishing to be invisible, wishing to even die in order to avoid the terrible pain of rejection and separation that one feels. Collapsing is where, instead of staying adult and in the moment, in the present, one goes on an instantaneous journey into the horrors of the past and reacts from that particular place. That idea of collapsing is one of the ways that causes that internal flame to begin to waver and sputter. So the question is, well, you can go back and you can look at all your material from your childhood and you can drag out all the beatings, all the rejections, all the crummy words, all the name-calling, all the things that happened to you. But that isn't going to turn the trick of keeping that flame burning bright. Because you see, the tender of that flame, the keeper of that flame, is the mother. And we're talking about an internal mother, not an external mother. If the external mother has failed you once, chances are that if she fails you once, she's not going to change so that she can fulfill you now. So what that means is that we have to grow an internal mother. And if things happened properly when you were a child, that would already be all grown within you already. But as it is, it probably is a very young mother who isn't quite sure what to do all the time, just like a truly young mother who has all the desire and all the wishes to do everything properly for her child, but is a little bit unsure of herself. And I want to tell you a psychic secret, something that is so simple that all of us, once we understand it, wonder why we didn't think of it ourselves. That psychic secret is, in order to grow the internal mother, you have to be willing to be decent and good to yourself. The more you are willing to accept self-love, self-respect, doesn't matter if your ears stick out or your hair stands on end or you're too short or you're too wide or you're too tall or you're too fat. It doesn't have anything to do with that. It has to do with caring about all the things that you are. You can have favorites. You can have some that have lesser place than others. But having a general caring for all the things that you are, that is what develops the internal mother. You can actually feel her grow and see her grow before your very eyes if you are willing to accept your own love and your own respect and your regard for yourself. Now, many people who have this very deep and tragic sense of being unmothered, sometimes it is a remnant for them. Sometimes it's a memory as close as yesterday. These people often feel that they are searching for love, that if they were just loved enough, everything would be so much better. It would be such a relief. And I'm here to tell you that that is not the case, that you can have love until it's coming out of your ears, and it won't work. And the reason it won't work is that what children need is not a slavish love that just says, I love you, I love you, I love you. No matter what you do, no matter how you do it, I love you, I love you, I love you. That's not enough. In fact, in Jungian theory, to do that to a child means to make them into an inflated little beast who thinks the world revolves around them and who has the complex of the golden child or the divine child. So even though we think that is what we would like to have, that's not really so. That won't turn the trick. What will is to have guidance, the guidance of intuition, the guidance of common sense, the guidance of consciousness. Consciously knowing what we're made of, what we're capable of, what our good points are, what our bad points are, and guiding ourselves through life with that knowledge. That is the deepest internal mothering that you can ever have. And if you are an unmothered child, that is what was missing in your upbringing. But have heart. No matter what happened to you, that light still lives inside of you. And I want to tell you a story called The Stolen Mother Moon. That is about a light. A certain kind of light is represented by the moon, which is it's a psychic light. It's a cool light. It has some distance to it. It isn't like what we call the hypertrophic mother who's all over her children, you know, every time their nose is running, she's afraid they have pneumonia and so on. This is a mother that's a little bit more aloof, more circumspect, and she does not so much love by showering love as she loves by guiding, by bringing consciousness out of the darkness. So there was this village. It was a wonderful village, and everything happened just the way it was supposed to happen, and all the children were terrific, and all the mothers and fathers loved each other, except, as there always must be in the psyche and in fairy tales, except there was this one thing that was very, very adverse. And that was that this beautiful, harmonious village was surrounded by a moat of black, murky bogs. And it was dark there always, and it stank because everything was rotting. And so it was for that reason, the darkness of those quagmires and the quicksand, that the people depended on the light of the moon to guide them at night. Some nights, she did not come. And on those nights, the bogs were filled with treachery because there were evil things that lived there. Things that live in the darkest corners of humans' minds would come out at night and lead the poor, struggling travelers with no light in to the quagmires and drowned them. Well, it turned out that several people died in the course of a very short amount of time, and when the Moon Mother learned of this, she was filled with sorrow, for she cared for humans. In fact, she was so concerned, she decided she would come to Earth and she would see for herself. So when the dark of the month came, she stepped onto a slow shooting star and landed at the edge of the marshes. And she wore a black cape pulled around her so that no light could escape. And for as far as she could see, the bogs were like black mirrors with a few sparse willows sticking up here and there and the smell of muck everywhere. Around the bottom of her cape, there was a bright donut of light. And she saw that, and she pulled her cape even tighter, and it was so cold, she was trembling. And she feared the evil ones, just as we all do. But she loved the human soul more. And so she began her investigation, guided by the little golden light that leaked through her cape over her beautiful white feet. She felt her way through the grass with the dank ponds on the left and the quagmires on the right. And just as she had thought she got the lay of the land, all of a sudden she felt a vine across her ankles, and too late to hold herself, she began to fall forward, and she reached for a twining tree, the kind under the control of the evil ones. And sure as she grabbed its branches, it sent out tendrils around her wrists and her ankles, holding her as though with manacles, and the more she struggled, the tighter it held her. And there she was, in the blackest dark, shivering and straining. And she heard a voice calling from far off, "Help me. Oh, please help." she listened, and the cry came nearer and nearer, and she heard footfalls stumbling. And at last, by the dim light of the stars, she saw a haggard, despairing face with fearful eyes, and she knew it was a poor soul who had lost his way and was floundering on to his death. And he now caught a sight of the glimmer of light from the captive moon and made his way toward the light, thinking it meant help. But there was a quagmire right in front of the moon, and she was filled with sorrow because she was luring him with her little tiny light, luring him to his death. And frantic to warn him, she struggled until her hood fell back. And her dazzling hair lit the black waters like a flood of yellow. The precious light of the moon mother glinted, and the whole was as bright as day. And how relieved the traveler was to see the evil ones rush back into their underwater holes. But the moon struggled against the branches which held her tighter, and she was so glad he was safe, but he ran to the edge of the marsh so quickly and with such haste and relief that he forgot to wonder about the wondrous thing that had just occurred. And the mother moon sank exhausted into the mud, and as she did, her head fell onto her breast, and her hood fell back over her hair, and all became darkness again. And the vile things that love the dark came too then, with a kind of whisper chatter. We'll get her now. We'll get her now. Now we'll kill her. Yes, we'll kill her. They gathered around the moon mother, snarling and kicking and grasping, and they drove her into the ground, they who hated humans. At last, no more light shone across those dark waters. And the one who gave light, and even more, the one who shone down on mothers nursing their babies, the one who made sleeping women kiss their lovers' backs, the one who put words into the dreams of poets, that one was pushed deep into the mud. For the evil ones didn't care about mothers or babies. They didn't care about lovers or poets. And the moon mother let one last ray of light zigzag over the waters before she disappeared completely, and the evil ones rolled a great boulder over her grave and danced a crazy dance on top of it. Till then, on nights there was no light to guide. And so many people became lost. And so many children became orphaned. And so many people suffered. That the villagers decided they must go and find what had become of the moon. And armed with torches and clubs, they trekked through the night into the bogs, sinking down into the wet and slimy grass all the way up to their knees. And cold and wet, they continued on, and the evil things were about and surrounded them, scratching and clawing at them. But the flames from the torches kept them safe. Till they came to a great boulder, and they said they did not think that this boulder was in this place before, and there was a little lip of light all the way around it that shone whiter than white. And with great excitement, they lifted and they hauled and they tugged until the boulder rolled away and left them staring down into what seemed like the most beautiful face they had ever seen, with eyes filled with the love of humanity. And the light rose up and up, lighting their faces first from beneath and then straight on and finally from the top as the moon mother escaped from her prison and climbed the dark staircase back to the sky, where now On most nights, she travels across the sky with her hood turned down and her light radiant everywhere. And on those few, now predictable nights, when she veils herself in gray and does not shine, travelers have learned to stay by the hearth and wait until she shows the way again. In Jungian psychology, when we tell a fairy tale, we consider that all the parts, all the characters in the fairy tale, are one single individual psyche. So in this story, The Stolen Mother Moon, the villagers, where there is paradise, would be one aspect of the psyche. The bogs, the terrible place where people would become lost and drown, would be another aspect of the psyche. The person who was not able to find his way home until the moon revealed herself would be another symbol of the psyche. And the moon mother herself, would be another. The evil things, or the evil ones, would also represent aspects of the psyche. And the villagers who come at the end, even though they're similar to the villagers at the beginning, they are no longer a harmonious, paradisical village. They are now an upset and despairing village, and a courageous one as well, who rescues the moon. They would represent another aspect of the psyche. So this essentially is a story about a paradise that's surrounded by, you might say, an accident waiting to happen. And you know, life is really fragile. It's really a miracle that we make it into this world to begin with. It's a very dangerous physiological journey, let alone spiritual journey. And while it is true that infancy is supposed to be a paradise, where all our needs are met and we're kept warm and our diapers are changed when need be and we're fed when we're hungry, even if all that goes right, the bogs are waiting just outside that paradise. And at some point in our very young lives, we do have to travel back and forth across those. Certainly, by the time we're school age, we have to confront some of the darker aspects of human nature, other children who won't share with us, who bite us and hit us. We have to deal with the darker side of human nature. Well, let's say in a normal family, that's supposed to come from outsiders. People who hit and hurt, that's supposed to come from outside the family, and those are the bogs that we need to learn to cross. In families where things go wrong, the bog is actually right inside the home, and it's the mother and the father, or one or the other, who does all the hurting and the biting. In which case, the paradiso is destroyed early on, and the child never really learns about light and guidance. Instead, they learn defensiveness, which serves them much later when they're adults in a very curious way. It's one of the powerful aspects of the orphan archetype. And that is that they're highly intuitive because they've suffered so much. They learned to develop radar to know where the next kick or the next hit was coming from. So as adults, they're very, very alert, and often uncannily so. And they not only can tell bad things, but also good things about people. And the only problem is they often override their intuition. Even though their intuition is, let's say, the most mega, super-duper intuition you could imagine, they often override it, especially if they think they'll get love. It's almost like a currency exchange that they do. However, going back again to the idea that you're supposed to come to those bogs outside the family, not inside the family, the thing that the kids learn within the family then is defensiveness and being afraid. Instead of being travelers, instead of being journeyers, they become afraid to make a move. Now, this particular fairy tale talks about the dark place in the psyche that exists just because. And the addition of the evil ones is what happens when there's severe abuse or neglect in a family. And I want to differentiate abuse and neglect. Abuse is where there's humiliation, shaming, inappropriate punishment, hitting, yelling, screaming, anything that causes the adrenaline to be raised in the children unnecessarily into a fight or flight response that they can truly do nothing about. Those are all forms of abuse. Name-calling is another one. Neglect is a totally different kind of feeling in the child. Neglect makes a child first melancholic, secondarily despairing. If it goes on long enough, the child will become a despairing person. Neglect is not like the mother won't buy a toy for the child. Neglect is where the mother does not pay attention to the child's feelings or needs. And there have been some studies done, some video studies done, of mothers who have had difficult births with their children, or their children have not been totally perfectly formed when they were born. And they did videos of the mothers feeding their children, and many of the children were falling practically right off the mother's laps, or the mothers would have a hold of them by a leg and be feeding them with a bottle with the other hand. And that would be a really good example of neglect. It's not abuse exactly. I mean, they're not dropping the baby on the head. They're not throwing the baby across the room. They're not yelling at the baby. But they are not holding and containing the baby in a way that we know that babies like to be held so that they can feel secure. So that would be an instance of neglect where the mother is simply unaware of the most basic need of the baby. Now, most mothers, thank goodness, have what we call a mothering response. You put a baby in their arms and they hold it close naturally. But some mothers, for some reason, don't have that, and we call those the mothering of neglect. Another aspect of neglect that is more common than most people like to think is where the parents are themselves little children, and they really don't know how to take care of a baby, other than let's pretend, let's play house. And in those cases, we find things like telltale signs like diaper rash, insufficient weight gain for infants, and so forth, because the mother, quote-unquote, forgot to feed the baby, because she's really young herself. And she could be really young in years, like she could be 15 or 16 years old, but she could also be young in maturity. So you could have a 35-year-old mother who did something like that because internally, for some reason, she is not yet a grown-up. So these are the kinds of evil things, you might say, that come out of the tangled psyche. Once someone has been misused, all kinds of evil thoughts are what we call introjected into their psyche. And an introject is sort of like a hypodermic needle filled with junk. It's like thoughts and feelings that are introduced into your body without your permission, but quickly, and you might say somewhat unconsciously, and they become a part of you. They take over, just like a chemical takes over and makes you do, think, act, feel certain ways that are not necessarily those of your conscious volition. So in the fairy tale, The Stolen Mother Moon, the evil ones represent those thoughts within the psyche that really are not only bad thoughts or negative thoughts, but they also are very anti-health. They're particularly threatened by light. This is a very interesting idea, because you see, our darkest thoughts really cannot exist in light. And if you want to interpret the mother as being love, I'm here to tell you that you can be loved all you like and still have evil thoughts about yourself. However, when you receive true guidance, when you either set your mind to giving yourself good guidance, or you receive some of that from outside yourself, from someone you trust, and you begin to incorporate that into your own psychic system, it's very hard for those evil thoughts to continue. And that's what this fairy tale is about. You understand that they say the evil ones hate the human heart, and the Mother Moon loves human beings. She has this almost immaculate, unending kind of humanity this tremendous feeling for human beings, so much so that she never, ever wants them to be lured into something that is irreversible. I find it interesting in this fairy tale that the Mother Moon isn't in the sky all the time. I think that's very interesting. And by the end of the story, the people of the village have learned not to go into the bogs during the time she's not there, which would be like one of my clients had a penchant for getting into the deepest and most horrific material of her history during the times when she felt really awful. So she'd have a fight with her boyfriend, or she'd be premenstrual, or whatever it was that was causing her some difficulty in her life. And darned if that wasn't the exact moment that she wanted to talk about the hateful father that she had had. And she wasn't able to see her way through the dark. She was halting and stumbling and slipping all over the place, and would even become angry with me if I suggested now was not exactly the time to do that. In other words, she was being scratched and clawed at by the evil ones, by her own negative thinking. So finally, she found her way with a glimmer of light, in other words, an intuition that came to her that went, oh, you know, the time to do work about hard things is when I feel relatively good. Therefore, I am stronger and I can see the pitfalls and I don't have to wallow around or drown in the feeling, you see. So this is a sort of, you might say, an archetype for doing the work that has to do with the abandonment or the abusing history, is to do that work when you feel relatively good rather than when you feel the most awful. This idea of the evil ones catching hold of the Moon Mother and pushing her into the earth, it's like a death and a resurrection again. And there is that truth, there's no doubt. You know, the old saying, the darkest time is just before dawn. In other words, the most tremendous feeling that we have of despair is a precursor to a great burst of light, whether in this case it's the moon rising back into the sky again, or whether it's the sun in the morning. The evil ones in this fairy tale have the ability to take this huge, enormous sphere, which symbolizes a wholeness, of course, or a completion, and push it in to the bog, into the darkness. And St. John of the Cross wrote about this, among other people, Catherine of Siena, Thomas Merton, wrote about this when you're on your journey and things are rolling along as should be, and you're knocking out those evil ones left and right with an uppercut to the left and, you know, a rabbit punch to the stomach, and everything's going great guns. And all of a sudden, you lose the light. You not only lose it, it's buried so deep, so far away, it has so much standing on top of it, you feel like you're never going to find it again. St. John of the Cross called it the dark night of the soul. And yet, ta-da, don't forget the villagers. The villagers are those aspects of ourself that are dedicated to harmony and to relationship. Mothers to children, husbands to wives, lovers to lovers. In other words, those needs in us to have relationship are the ones that search out the light. They say, well, this is just awful. We're losing, you know, we're losing pieces and parts of our psyche left and right, and we just need to go find this. And often the finding occurs because the person has a big dream. And as you know, in Jungian psychology and Jungian dream analysis, a big dream might only be one sentence long. The person has a big dream, and as a result, the light comes back again. They say, aha! Ah, I see now, I see. Well, what they see, of course, is up to the individual. But usually it has to do with something about the original abandonment, the original abuse, the original horror has some reason and meaning in it. It is not senseless. It is not like being run down like a dog on the highway. Its meaning most often is the development of tremendous strength, tremendous power, tremendous intuition. And I will tell you frankly, and most of the people who are the greatest healers living on the face of this earth are unmothered children. One of the great gifts of the unmothered child, and also the healer, and the writer, and the musician, and all of those in the arts who live so close with their ear against the heartbeat of the archetypal unconscious, one of the strongest aspects is intuition. When I was a young woman, I was lucky enough to be very close to a family of German storytellers, old, old women who had come from the old country in the 1950s, and their families had been torn apart. All the men were gone, all the children were gone, and they were the only survivors. And they dressed in black, and they had 12 sweaters on and 4 skirts on, and they were a wonderful, wonderful group of people. And I was, when they came, probably about 10 years old, and I decided that I would try to help them learn English. And in return for that, they used to tell me fairy tales, half in German, half in English. But you know, in situations like that, you understand a great deal more than is being said. One of the fairy tales that they really love to tell and I love to hear is called Red Cap. And in the English version, you probably know it as Little Red Riding Hood. But this version of Red Cap is unlike any that you've ever heard in Grimm's fairy tales. In fact, as you probably understand, Grimm cleaned up their fairy tales considerably. And in the old, old Red Cap fairy tale that preceded the Grimm's Red Riding Hood fairy tale, and Perrault's Red Riding Hood as well, there was no hunter that came at the end and cut open the wolf and retrieved the grandmother and etc. This is the real story. Little Red Cap was an orphan. Her mother and father had died, but she did have a grandmother who lived far away, even though she had never met her. And one day she decided that she would set out through the forest and she would go find this mythical grandmother that she had never seen. And as she was in the very midst of the forest, a wolf stepped onto the path and he said, "Little Red Cap, where are you going?" And the little girl said, "Well, I'm going to meet my grandmother. And I've never seen her before and I don't know what she looks like. But I'm very much looking forward to it because she's my only relative." And the wolf was very crafty and had very long ears and he had a very thin pencil mustache and he thought to himself, "Aha, well, this is an ideal situation." And so he stepped back into the woods and ran all the way to the grandmother's house and went in and took one look at her, and she was so plump and so juicy he ate her up just quick as a wink. And he got into her night clothes, and he went to bed. And pretty soon, there was a little tiny tap at the door. And he said, "Come in." And it was Little Red Cap. And she said, "Oh, Grandmother, I am so glad to meet you at last." And well, you know, she had lived close to a village at one time, and she knew that old women could grow beards and mustaches, and that sometimes they could even grow hair out of their ears, so she wasn't surprised that her grandmother looked like this. Well, the grandmother, who was really the wolf, said to her, "Oh, your clothes are all dirty from the forest, so I think you should take them off, and I think you should get into bed with me and get warm. You must be cold, having traveled all through the forest." And Little Red Cap said, "Well, I think that's a good idea," and that's what she did. And she crawled into bed with the wolf. And the wolf said to her, "Oh, Little Red Cap, it's so nice holding you close. You are just the nicest, warmest little girl." Well, Little Red Cap had some second thoughts. She was looking at those ears, and they were really bigger than any she had ever seen before. And so she said so. She said, "You know, you have the biggest ears I've ever seen." And the wolf thought for a moment. He said, "Well, that's so I can hear things from far away, especially nice little girls coming through the woods." And so that quieted Red Cap for a while, and she lay there for a while more in that wonderful feather bed with the wolf. And then she got to thinking about it, and she said, "You know, you really do have a really, really big nose." And he said, "Well, yes, of course I have a big nose. You see, I need to be able to smell things from far away, you know, like little girls like you." Well, Redcap got really nervous. She thought, "I don't know, there's something wrong here." So she made up a story and she said to the wolf, "You know, I have to go to the bathroom. I must leave the bed and go outside and go to the bathroom." And the wolf said, Oh no, I don't want you to do that. I want you to stay here with me." And little Redcap said, No, I'll tell you what. If you're afraid I'll run away or something, I'll just take my little red cap here and I'll unravel a thread and I'll tie it around my ankle and you can hold on to the other end of it and I'll go outside and you'll see I won't go anywhere." And so that's what they did. She unraveled her little red cap and she tied one end around her ankle and she went outside, and the wolf was laying in bed with his babushka on and his nightgown on, with his big ears and his pencil mustache. And he was thinking, "Oh, when she comes back in, I'm just going to eat her up all in one gulp." But you know, little Redcap knew something was wrong, so she took that thread off of her ankle and she tied it to a tree and she ran away. You know, I hate to see wolves have bad press because they are wonderful and beautiful creatures, except to ranchers and sheep herders, of course. But wolves are thought to be ravenous. And I can imagine, having grown up in the woods myself, that when you see wolves peeking out of the forest looking toward your house at dusk, it does give you a rather eerie feeling that they're always hanging around looking for something and then disappearing and then appearing again at strange and unusual times. But again, in a fairy tale, all parts of the fairy tale represent the psyche of a single individual. So in this fairy tale, we have a wolf, and we have a little girl, and we have a grandmother who gets eaten up, and we have, essentially, again, the orphan psychology. We have a tiny little, you might say, potential, feminine emotional potential that is without mother and without father. It's totally without guidance, and it's even without grandmother, the wise old woman. It's without a very mature outlook on life. It knows almost nothing, in other words, about life and death. And yet, even so, even in this most unformed state, this child, even though she, you might say, she made an error by getting into bed with the wolf to begin with, pretty soon her intuition began to turn on its gears, and pretty soon she realized intuitively that this was not a good thing to do. And not only that, she figured a way out of it that convinced the wolf that he was going to get what he wanted while she ran away. This is typical of the intuitive style of the unmothered child. If they will pay attention, they might find themselves halfway into a messy situation, but if they will pay attention, they're usually able to go out the way they came in. They're able to back out of the situation and get away. Simply, one of the odd characteristics of being abused is that it seems to dawn on people like that a lot sooner than on people who have been treated very well all their lives.
This concludes Session 1 of Warming the Stone Child with Dr. Clarissa Pinkola Estes.
I ran to the treetops, I ran to the sky, up to the lake, into the rain that matted my hair and soaked my shoes and skin, hid my tears, hid my fears. I ran to the forest, I ran to the trees, I ran and I ran, I was looking for me. I ran past the churches, in the crooked old mailbox, past the apple orchards and lady that never talks, up into the hills I ran to the cemetery and held my breath and thought about your death. I ran to the lake, up into the hills, I ran and I ran, I'm looking there still, and I saw the crumbling tombstones, all the forgotten names. I tasted the rain, I tasted my tears, I cursed the angels, I tasted my fears. And the ground gave way beneath my feet, and the earth took me in her arms. Leaves covered my face, ants marched across my back, black sky opened up, blinding me. I ran to the forest, I ran to the trees, I ran and I ran, I was looking for me. Ran to the lakes, up to the hill, ran and I ran, I'm looking there still, and I smelled her burning flesh, her rotting bones, her decay. I ran and I ran, I'm still running away.
She thinks that I was with my friend. strolling through the used condoms strewn on the piers off the West Side Highway, sunset behind the skyline of Jersey, walking towards the water with a fetus holding court in my gut, my body hijacked, my tits swollen and sore. The river has more colors at sunset than my sock drawer ever dreamed of. I could wake up screaming sometimes, but I don't. I could step off the end of this pier, but I got shit to do and an appointment on Tuesday to shed uninvited blood and tissue. I'll miss you, I say to the water, to the sun, a daughter, I thought better of. I could fall in love with Jersey at sunset, but I leave the view to the rats and tiptoe back.
I am Velocity Child, and every Friday at the stroke of midnight, ride the broomstick with fallen woman, stirring up the cauldron at Radio Free Brooklyn.